Thank you for joining me for this second portion of today's sixth CEU seminar entitled Beyond the Medical Model. As I mentioned the end of our last section, that we will begin this section talking about the concept of instilling hope, which the research and the literature in terms of actual functions that we do as therapists suggests is one of the most important types of things we can offer. Hope has a couple different areas that it's made up of. These are called willpower and waypower. Let me give you an example that would show this further. So I remember there was a lady who had come to the inpatient psych hospital that I used to work at. And one of the many things that we talked about in our thorough assessment was about goals or strengths or talents that the person might have. And that particular lady said that she had the goal in life of wanting to be a teacher. So I wanted to hear what it was that she enjoyed about teaching. In the back of my mind, I knew because there was something she had said earlier in the assessment that she had an eighth grade education. I knew she had not even gotten through ninth grade, much less graduated high school or gotten a GED. I knew to that point she had not gone to college and wasn't intending to go to college. So I was curious about hearing for her what the hope was about being a teacher. So I said, oh, tell me more about that. Again, using the open-ended questions that we use to elicit responses from our clients. And she said, you know, I'm really good with kids. Everyone's always told me I'm a great babysitter. I get on the kids' level. I'm creative. I'm funny. So she had these attributes that we talked about in the last section, things like curiosity, wonder, creativity. And so she had the willpower to make a difference in the children's lives. But in terms of the way power to, as a teacher, do that, as an elementary or a secondary level teacher, that was not something that at the current level of development was going to happen. Of course, I wasn't going to burst her bubble, but I wanted to hear what her dream was. So this is a great example that highlights really hearing what the client's theme is and where he or she's coming from. So willpower and waypower, both are required to really fully have the concept of hope. Another way this is conceptualized and talked about in the literature about instilling hope is by using the terms agency and pathways. Agency is, can I dream it? Can I imagine it? Yeah, I'd love to, for example, be a next sports star. But do I have the stamina to do the training? Have I demonstrated skills, focus? What have I done? Do I have the pathways to actually be a sports star, a Olympic medalist? So just because I hope or dream something, how realistic is it? How can I instill hope? I remember another young man when I was working at that same hospital who said that one of the things he had thought of was he was going to be the next basketball star. And so I was able to talk with him. I said, oh, so you must be pretty skilled at basketball then. Tell me more about that. So you're going outside quite a bit, playing in the neighborhood with your friends, or are you on a sports team at school? Or no, he said, I don't need to practice. I'm just talented. And what was interesting is this young man was saying, well, his dad actually was mentioning that he had some issues with substance use, with marijuana use, with low motivation, with lack of follow through on many things, including schoolwork, including the sports follow through. And so the assumption of the young man was, oh, I don't need to practice. Even though a star like Michael Jordan needs to practice his basketball, I'm special, I'm different. So again, rather than arguing the point with him, we were able to look at what would some pathways be to get to that goal. So that's, again, where that acronym we talked about in the first section, SMART, where that comes in. There's a thing in the literature called the New Integrative Hope Scale. The idea in terms of building resiliency is there's no hope without stress, loss, or possibility of things getting worse. In order to build resiliency, there has to be a degree of stress. There needs to be an openness to the surprises of life. The literature uses this phrase of finding the sacred in despair. So one of the things I'll actually do with a client to that end is I'll mention, you know, I love to be able to promise you that there won't be more trials or more stresses. I know you've been through some changes. I know you shared with me some of the things that you've already struggled with. And while I can't promise you there won't be trials, one of the things through the skill development, through the practices we work in counseling, can be learning how to focus on what I can realistically do in the midst of that. It takes the idea of being persistent, of having resiliency to promote wholeness and even striving and thriving, which the thriving could also be termed post-traumatic growth. It is possible to grow even in the midst of things. So what we're measuring when we're looking at this with the client in terms of positive psychology is the client's ability to consider positive possibilities. Instead of being locked down or feeling trapped or hopeless or helpless by the past or by what they feel are limitations, we can help them consider positive possibilities. We can help them be forward focused. If you recall the term in the literature called locus of control, we know that it's dangerous for a client to have too much of an outward locus of control or too much of an internal locus of control. Meaning, if they believe their success or failure is so linked to what other people out there do or don't do, that can keep them stuck to where they just feel doomed, like, oh great, now I can't do anything about this because this other person didn't do A, B, and C. Or if they put too much overemphasis on themselves, if I do all the good, right, strong, perfect things, that internal locus of control, that can be dangerous too. So having that balance, reinforcing their values and what's valuable to them. The idea that even when there is a stuckness, there can be a way out of that stuckness. There can be, within reason, an internal locus of control in spite of external stressors. We can talk about empathizing with a client's narrative. It's okay for them to have and process feelings, even the frustrations in the midst of things. And it's okay to discover and acknowledge strengths in the midst of what feels like weakness. I like solution-focused, strengths-based types of approaches because they use scaling. So instead of it being an all or nothing where the client's feeling like it's ominous that they're having to jump from a presenting concern to trying to get hope and feeling ultra motivated, we're just talking about one step in the right direction. So let's say a client's saying they're coming in because they're stuck, they're depressed, they're not very motivated in certain areas. So I might use a 1 to 10 scale with them to look at, okay, what would it look like if you're saying that you're feeling like your level of motivation is only a 2 or 3 right now, that it's really hard to get going? what might a 3 to a 4 be? The more we can be specific and concrete, again, using that SMART acronym, the better it may turn out. So the things that this new integrative hope scale measure are things like trust and confidence. Does our client actually believe that they have inner strengths, that each day has potential, that there is a sense of forward movement, that there's a sense of direction? Again, not that we have all the resources and know all the ins and outs of how to survive things, but that they do have a sense of worth, a sense of purpose, a sense of forward direction in life, then that can cultivate hope. One of the things that has a negative correlation, on the other hand, with hope, is someone who has a lack of perspective, who believes that it's hard to keep up their interest in activities they used to enjoy, that their support systems are not there, that they're kind of ruminating or like a broken record about the problems in their life, that they feel trapped or pinned down. One of the things that is very helpful when we're measuring hope is the degree to which this person has a positive future orientation. And again, we're looking at both of the concepts of willpower and waypower, not just the ability to dream it as a hope and a dream or a possibility, but the ability to actually take some forward moving steps toward it. So could a client essentially say, yeah, there are things I dream about or would like to do or achieve in my life? Yeah, I'm looking forward to certain plans. If they're having a positive future orientation, this would definitely be in line with hope. And do they have social supports? When I did a seminar in the past about the concept of forgiveness, one of the things that the literature suggested to move beyond into accepting forgiveness and actually cultivating that rather than resentment and bitterness in relationships was people knowing that they had the support, social supports and affirmation. And so when someone feels needed, wanted, and valued, those qualities of mattering we talked about earlier, that can cultivate hope. The literature said that there's 4 categories, actually, of goals that we would consider hopeful goals. First of all, hopeful goals are approach goals. We're moving towards a desired outcome. One of the things is we may need to help hold a client accountable in terms of the how of what types of steps will they take towards something. I always tell clients why is a dangerous question because why cultivates circular thinking, but how and what are much more concrete and behavioral. They're operational. So if a client says, I want to be a teacher, but as in that woman's case, they just graduated elementary school, I might, tell me more about how you're going to interact with children. Or the young man who was going to be the famous basketball player. I want to hear about how basketball came to be an important thing to you and what ways you're demonstrating and showing people around you that basketball is a very important part of your life. So approaching these goals. A second category of hopeful goals is that they actually deter unwanted consequences. So while they're forward moving, they're actually moving away from the negative things. The other thing that hopeful goals do is that they're maintenance goals. Even if something stays the same and a healthy goal is maintained, that's a positive in terms of a strengths-based solution-focused approach. Because if it stays the same, by that token, it's not getting worse. And finally, a fourth category of hopeful goals is that of enhancement goals, augmenting things, augmenting skills that are already there. Hope also should be reasonable, according to an article by Weingarten. Reasonable hope, highlights the importance of community. Whether we may feel like we lack a skill inside, we can link to other people who can help support us in that. So the support systems, again, in building those for clients is important. Reasonable hopes are a practice. So frequently I'll tell clients, just because you feel like it took a while to develop the concerns and the problems and the presenting issues, it may take some repetition and some time for it to become a new practice, some of the different approaches and ways we're looking at things. Reasonable hope goes back to that balanced optimism we talked about in the last section of today's seminar. That maintaining that the future is open, that it's uncertain, but it is influenceable. Optimism doesn't deny that there are surprises in life. But what I tell clients, if your anxiety goes to the worst that might happen, you might as well consider what the positive or the neutral could be that could happen. In many cases, it's just as likely that the neutral or positive will happen. Reasonable hope is goal-oriented. A lot of what we can do towards helping clients have more of a positive outlook is helping them make manageable, achievable goals. Sometimes our clients don't know how to do that. They may struggle with any of those parts of SMART, of specific, measurable, achievable. It also accommodates the idea that life can be messy. Now, the good news in all of this is that hope is something that can vicariously be learned. Sometimes things like bibliotherapy or even watching a YouTube video about someone who had a perceived limitation of some sort, who actually overcame that or had strengths, can actually help a client. In narrative therapy, we can look at things like restorative narratives. Narratives where even though certain parts of the story may not have been what the client wanted, that the story's ongoing. There's language we can use in terms of the coupling, the partnership, and the therapeutic alliance that facilitates hope and a positive optimism with our clients. First of all, we can ask questions like, how did you manage? It's real different for a client being on the receiving end of hearing, how did you manage, rather than, how did you not be just utterly overwhelmed when this and this and this was happening? We can help cultivate hope by helping them look at good things in spite of the unpleasant. This goes back to that gratitude, thankfulness can be cultivated. Clients can choose what they focus on. We can help cultivate hope by helping people endure and build on strengths they have or remember positive memories. One of the challenges for many of our clients, however, is comparison. I find, and sometimes I have to actually say this to a client, that clients tend to let others in their life, oftentimes off the hook, to give them more mercy, but not to necessarily give themselves that same mercy. So one of the keys in terms of cultivating hope is helping our clients to avoid that deadly thing of comparison. Comparison really pushes clients towards an unhealthy threat bias. It facilitates a negative perception of things that actually may not be quite so negative. It helps a client to look at what's wrong. It makes the client forget that they even had coping skills, when a lot of times they do have some skills that could work. But the alternative, with positive psychology, with the acceptance and commitment therapy, and being values-based, is that problems are faced head-on. Possibilities and options can be considered. There's options of what could be right. Like I said, using that phrase, what's right for the client, and there's healthy options and choices. A sense of humor can build resiliency. I've known people that have collected little sayings or motivational things just to remind themselves that maybe life isn't just as strict as I made it, as unpleasant. Laughter can be a wonderful coping mechanism. And actually, even in the seminar I teach on de-stressing the therapist and us moving away from burnout, one of the things that's suggested is to keep a little notebook, of course, in a way of protecting the confidential nature of any cases, but kind of looking at the success stories. What can I smile about? What's positive? What can I laugh about? What initially felt frustrating and like a problem, but that ended up being a success story? We can encourage our clients toward that as well. Self-efficacy is another term that the literature uses a lot in terms of something that can be cultivated. This refers to proactively looking at internal strengths and abilities, seeing what has been done or demonstrated in the past. So maybe, for example, I'm going through a slump now. Maybe I'm going through a time of low motivation. Maybe I'm having difficulty being forward moving. What can I do at this point? So it's this balance between skill cultivation of new skills as well as skill affirming of existing skills and modeling after other successes. Sometimes when there are frustrations in life and when our clients are coming to us with presenting concerns, there's this search for what the literature would call meaning making, especially when there's grief. When something has felt to a client like it's gone wrong, it's important to help them reconceptualize things, to see them in a positive light. There could be actually positive value in everyday activities, that there can still be realistic, achievable, meaningful goals in spite of some of the limitations. Maybe things might need to be modified a little bit from the initial way of looking at it, but it still can cultivate some level of hope. I always tell clients the importance of getting started. I say, okay, let's start with something, and if we need to, we can always modify it. And sometimes, you know, to me, I feel like a broken record, but to them, they say that's very beneficial hearing again and again, you have choices. There are options. There are ways of looking at things. You can get started. What's the worst thing that can happen? We can reconceptualize things and rework it. Meaning making also goes back to that mattering and that connection and being cared for by others, knowing that someone cares and having a sense of achievement, feeling hope and optimism, holding on to spirituality, and knowing there is a meaning in life. I mentioned earlier the dangerousness of why. Why is a realistic question. It comes naturally to most of us when we've gone through stresses in life. It's easy to think, if only I understood why, things would be better. But the fact of the matter is, even like I tell clients, if I could magically tell you why, it wouldn't really make it better. That we still need to create a plan of action of what to do from here. So clients do find it freeing when I help them shift from why to what and how. What and how are very action-oriented. They're concrete. They're behavioral. And it goes back to what I referred to earlier, that camera check. What do I do from here? What resources do I need? What would be different? Again, thinking in terms of that miracle question. How do I manage from here? How do I get to the desired behavior? So we're first helping a client to identify a value. Then we're helping that client to specify goals. That would be that ability to dream, the willpower. Third, we're making sure of the acronym SMART and the WAY power. Does this client have the ability to take action? In which ways can we cultivate that? Fourth, as action's taken and we're modifying, we're identifying barriers. And five, we're taking time to review. And that review isn't just a review of problems, which is usually what comes naturally to our client, but it's a review of what's gone well. I always tell people, especially in relational or systems-based counseling, when they're talking like with a spouse or a family member, it's important for us to process when things go well. Because the mistake we often make is when things are going kind of okay, we don't say much. We just kind of cross our fingers and are pretty happy that it didn't go worse. This is great. There wasn't more stress. But it's important to highlight that if things go well, it's not just by accident. There were some choices someone made. And if they made those choices, they could make them again. So if we look at solution-focused approaches, we can look at the reasons why people have problems, that a lot of times they do things that don't really work. You know that saying, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. People also might have problems because they don't have an expectation of change. Maybe there's just lack of insight or awareness. Maybe they're doing the right things actually, but not doing it enough in terms of frequency. Maybe not doing it in the context, or they may be unwilling to just do something different. The idea is there are things that work in spite of what doesn't work. So we're helping clients to actually look for those positive exceptions. We're planning experiments and tests. We're helping them see what those exceptions are. So they may be self-reporting to us the things that they find negative or discouraging. But there's always some good, even in the bad or unpleasant circumstances. And that's where learned optimism comes in. Nothing can possibly stay awful forever. Over time, something's going to change. And it can change for the better or the neutral. If you've done something that worked, you could do it twice. You could do it a little more of the time. You could make it more of a habit. It may just take time. If you've done something for a small length of time, you eventually can make it a habit. Clients wouldn't come to us if there wasn't a part of them deep down that thought that things could be better. And the idea is that a lot of times clients have some degree of answers within them, more than they give themselves credit for. The reason I like solution-focused approaches is because clients truly are perceived as the experts on their lives, instead of me or you as clinicians coming in and saying, yeah, this is what you need to do. Let me tell you, based on my schooling, do A, B, and C. It's seen as more of a therapeutic partnership. Treatment doesn't have to be scripted in order to be successful. So we're focusing on clients' strengths. We're using what essentially is a success-driven model. We're building solutions. We're focusing on desired outcomes. Sounds mighty different than the medical model that we talked about at the very beginning, huh? We're using success-based language. How have you managed? And we're reminding clients they do have a resource within themselves already. One of the things that is one of the tenets of solution-focused approaches is that things will eventually change. The automatic, negative, unpleasant thought that many clients have is, oh gosh, things are going to change. Whoa, what am I going to face? But instead, an alternative thought is, I can actually plan for change. I tell clients, did you ever think that you could plan for conflict ahead of time? You could actually decide where you're going to go, what you're going to do instead, how you'll fill up that time, if the argument, if the goals are not going well, I can plan for change instead of avoiding it, since change is inevitable. Instead of fighting against it, I can help amplify change. That's a useful role we can be in as a therapist. We can be amplifiers of change, and the fact that clients can be involved proactively in that change. We're helping the clients to look for positive exceptions, even in the issue of the stressor or presenting problem. When are there times where it's not occurring? Are there parts of the situation or reactions which are useful? There's that magic word again, useful. Remember we talked about that earlier, about positive psychology, what is useful, what works. Now granted, something may work for our client and it might not work for me or it might not work for you, but finding out what works for this person, that's what the art of therapy is about. No problem happens all the time. We could create a dialogue with our client about when they don't have the problem or when the situation is less bad. Because the fact is there's some good even in the bad. There's no true problems that are 100% problems. Actually, there's opportunities to reconceptualize things. There's no failures, only ways of learning in spite of things. There's thousands of options and solutions. It's not about uncooperative people and external locus of control that feels helpless, but there's people with unique ways of cooperating. The miracle question that I've referred to a few times so far is really essentially a virtual reversal of the problem. Like with young kids, I might say, oh, what are three wishes? What are some things, if you could think of things differently, what would be happening? Since our clients have already come to us rehearsing the problem focus, rehearsing the things that keep them bound, what might it be like if we help our clients to rehearse their preferred future instead? If their problems were just solved like that? The idea that they can co-construct a new narrative with the therapist. The literature calls this deliberate wordsmithing. We can talk into being things that actually are positive. We can bring forth possibilities and frame things as a new start. Let me give you some examples of what are called exception questions. Again, the narratives can plant a very positive, optimistic seed in the client's mind. So questions like, when was the problem less severe? What was happening? When doesn't the problem happen? I like that. That was a new one for me when I first learned a strengths-based, solution-focused approach, because my background was in counseling psych in my master's program. And with that, we were taught to break down into small pieces the narrative of what's the problem, what are the symptoms. Let's talk about the depression. Let's talk about the mood swings, the anxiety, the addiction. Let's talk it to death. Let's break it apart. But the idea of actually asking about when it's not happening catches sometimes the therapist, but definitely the client off guard. So if I have a client who's saying, my sleep's awful, I can't get a whole sleep through the night. And I'm like, well, tell me about when you last had a decent sleep. When was the last time you felt refreshed? Oh, it was years ago, before I took the job I'm on now. Oh, what did you say? Oh, before I took the job I'm on now. Oh, so something about the narrative surrounding the job you're at now gets you worried, keeps you thinking, keeps your mind ruminating. Let's process that. Let's talk more about the alternatives. It's like when I talked to a client recently, sometimes the overcoming and the moving beyond the presenting concern has to do with giving enough time to really work it in reverse, to do the opposite of what hasn't been working. How could I recreate things? How could I do more of what works? So the coping questions include, how did you manage? What resources do you have? How could you do that again? What gets you through each day? What is your greatest support? How have you gotten through this? I love using the narrative surrounding the Serenity Prayer because it highlights this dynamic that nothing stays awful forever. Give me the courage to change the things I can change, the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the wisdom to know the difference. I actually will sit with a client and divide up those columns. Usually the first and foremost thing that's automatically in a client's mind when they're coming into us is what they can't change. They can think up pretty quickly many examples of what they cannot change, what they feel helpless about, what they think is happening to them, all the negative, automatic, awful parts. But one of the things they might need a little more help talking through with us is what they can change. I tell them there was a time years ago where I thought, oh my, look at all these things out of my control and felt helpless. But then over time, I realized actually it's good that I can't change everything. It's good that I don't have to work myself to death and have my hands in every angle of things. So looking at what I can change and the wisdom to know the difference. Because sometimes the frustration that our clients feel on top of their presenting concern is trying to change things that for whatever reason maybe aren't ready to change. Maybe it's not the right timing. So we're helping the clients to create changing narrative. It could be restorative narratives. Restorative narratives are stories even of other people that have gone through stuff. We can use those narratives to provide insight into themselves, their beliefs, their values again. Remember, values and committed action was something we highlighted, and their choices. I always tell clients, after I've heard their narrative, after so many sessions, I may say, you know what? I know it feels like so much has happened to you to this point. I know it feels like the chapters of your life have been written. But what would it be like if you could be the author of the next so many chapters of your life and be proactive? Who would you put in the narrative? You get to choose the characters. People that have been in your life can be in your life, but maybe to a lesser degree or to a more frequent degree in the story. Their attributes might be different. The boundaries, the setting, a lot of aspects of the story can change. But I tell them, remember that the narrative is ongoing. What optimism does that create? So helping to consider various endings to the story. Now the literature talks about doing some group therapy. And sometimes in terms of the values of group therapy, one of the biggest one is identification, where group members actually can play off of each other's strengths and realize, hey, there's a lot of commonalities we have in the human condition. There's things I've gone through. Oh, you went through that too? Well, I'm not alone, because it's natural to feel alone in some of the limitations. But to create a change, a positive change-based narrative, that can be something that oftentimes can even be done in a very helpful way in a group setting. Toward that goal, one of the stories the literature talks about is a story called The Caterpillar, which I love that metaphor because we see the becoming in the process of change from the caterpillar to the butterfly and the wrestling that the caterpillar has to get to being a butterfly. This is something that can create a lot of dialogue in group therapy. So I'm going to read through a little bit about this story of the caterpillar, and you can see how you could use this. The caterpillar. Once upon a time, There was a caterpillar named Anna. Anna thought, I'm not colorful like birds. I do not flutter, fly, or pollinate flowers like butterflies. I don't make beautiful noises like crickets. I'm really different. As the caterpillar grew, she noticed that the children were even afraid of her. Some children would occasionally say, ew, or yuck, when they saw her. Even when they didn't say anything mean, she thought that they were thinking they did not like her. She wondered why she couldn't be like the others, the birds or the crickets, or even the soft and fuzzy squirrels. She thought those other creatures must be so much happier than she. All she knew was she felt ugly. Now that's something that could be talked about in a group, the idea of how our feelings lie to us. Let's see this next part of the story. But mostly though, she didn't think anyone noticed her or cared about her. With all these sad thoughts, it's no wonder Anna felt bad and sad. Why did this happen to me? She would cry. Why can't I be a beautiful bird? No one else knows how it feels to be me. Why? 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 My destiny is to be ugly and to repulse others. This sounds a lot like negative attributions. Part of what we're trying to do with the restorative narratives, with the optimism, with the positive psychology, the acceptance and commitment therapy, and the strengths-based work is to help people notice an alternative narrative. She was afraid to tell others how hurt and sad she felt. Once she tried to tell someone how she felt, and they ignored her. And this hurt even worse. She thought, that's it. I can't trust people, and I can't trust what I think and feel either. I'm just an ugly caterpillar. So Anna went on, fighting with herself and fighting against the world and how she thought people saw her. She met several other caterpillars. They all quickly became friends. Anna somehow mustered up the courage to tell the other caterpillars how she felt. They chuckled to themselves and told her she was beautiful inside, and someday she would realize this beauty. Deep inside, they said, you are a beautiful butterfly. She thought, yeah, right, I'm beautiful. Come on, they're just saying that. I'm beautiful on the inside or on the outside. Nah, I'm not beautiful on the inside or the outside. The caterpillars told her in order to become a butterfly, she'd need to look inside for the beauty and the strength. That they could talk with her and support her, but she had to believe in herself and have faith. And only then she could do what was necessary to change into a beautiful butterfly. Anna thought this was a hopeless and very silly thing to do. She thought this was fine for her friends, but she was different. She was more ugly and way worse off than them. Even though my friends are caterpillars, she said, I'm different and more hopeless than them. So she sat and sat and sat and watched her friends turn into butterflies and fly away. One day she became sick and tired of sitting. That's it, she said. I'm going to really try to believe I'm beautiful. I'm going to think positive thoughts, and I'm going to feel better, even if a little part of me is afraid to do that. I'm going to really look inside myself for my beauty. I'm not going to fight myself anymore. And then she put her energy into trying to find the beauty and thinking positively and trying to be happy. It was so hard, though. She had to be very patient, and that was really frustrating. But she tried and tried and tried to see her beauty. As she tried, she noticed and began to develop a warm, safe cocoon around her little caterpillar body. It just sprang up. It felt a little scary and weird, but a little nice also. She wanted to fight it, but she didn't fight it. She embraced it. but eventually the cocoon started to feel very comfortable and safe. Then one day she emerged from the cocoon, a beautiful butterfly. So when something like this is used as an exercise in terms of group therapy, this can be a great way to cultivate the positive narrative. There's so many different elements of the story that clients can relate to. The struggle, the automatic negative feelings, the self-criticism, the wrestling with, yeah, other people are encouraging me. They think I'm this, but I just don't feel it. I'm not so sure. I'm different. Again, that narrative of I'm different and I'm more hopeless. And that feeling like someone's choosing to attend to the unpleasant. We, again, can cultivate things like mindfulness with our clients, choosing in the here and now what they focus on. There's a lot of ways of doing this. I will talk with clients about the ideas of things like imagining a conveyor belt. And maybe there's a box on the conveyor belt that's collected all the self-critical thoughts, all the anxieties, all the depression, all the problem narratives. And while the box is passing by in front of us on the conveyor, we can decide how much we want to stare in the box, take the things in the box out, look at them, or if we can allow it to just go past on the conveyor belt. Again, acceptance is not denying that we feel that self-critical stuff, that we're stuck, that we're frustrated, but realizing, okay, it passes by, but then it fades out of view. Even though I feel different and more hopeless, this caterpillar, I'm tired of sitting. I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of things not changing. One of the sentences that I'll tell clients that they say really makes a difference for them is it sounds like deep inside there's a part of you that has enough self-respect that says, you know, this isn't working for me. I'm not sure how to get to the new place. I'm not sure how to believe better, but I know I want to think something different. And so maybe part of what we're doing is helping them to get there. But sometimes having these dialogues in a group setting can help them feel not alone. As I stated before, the misunderstanding is that just simply avoiding pain, avoiding problems, isn't the same as proactively pursuing pleasure. So some of what we might have to teach our clients is how to develop healthy self-care. I know that sounds like a realistic goal. It sounds good. But many of our clients have this, what I call, someday narrative. Maybe after I've helped everyone else in my life, I can look at doing something positive. Well, maybe eventually there's this time or this way. So it never really comes to the point that they put themselves on the list. So I tend to go back to that how and what. How will you know when it is your time? What will you do for yourself? So we can use cognitive behavioral strategies to challenge a false belief that it's not okay for them to take care of themselves. I might say something like, is it a fact that you just have to wait till someday? That it's not your time, that just here to help everyone else? Who says? According to whom? And why is what that person says so important? Or why is it the truth? Is there any other way of thinking about this? How is thinking about this actually helping me? And if this thought or behavior is not helping and not life-giving, encouraging, or promoting healing, how can I continue to tell myself this? Is there anything to be gained by blaming or fault-finding? So we can promote healthy goal setting. We can use the camera check. We can help them to verbalize their needs to others. We can normalize those frustrations. That's where the group work really comes in. And we can help develop accountability for self-care habits. Mindfulness includes things like observing what's happening as it's happening, observing the world around you with curiosity and openness. Remember, we talked about some of those attributes that could be cultivated and affirmed. Don't push away the feelings, but allow them just to pass through. So you could use the metaphor I just used, like the conveyor belt. Or another one that I've used with people has been like a river passing through, and say there's a leaf floating on it. And the leaf represents the cares, the concerns, the presenting problems. Again, we're not picking it up. We're not examining it. We're not hyper-focusing on it. We're allowing the leaf to float past us and float downstream. But eventually, as it floats downstream, it goes out of sight. Another variation that I use with people is the idea of like a message in a bottle. So if the client can imagine something that represents the struggles that they're going through, the concerns, but that as it floats out to sea, eventually it floats to the horizon, where you really can't see that bottle clearly anymore. So the objective is to work on the locus of control and deciding what a client is going to attend to. A variation of this, a cognitive behavioral skill that'll teach clients, I call watch where you put your butts. I know it's a funny name, but you know, it helps clients to remember that. So the first part of the statement would be to admit realistically the unpleasant feelings, the concerns or worries, the irrational thoughts, the questions or doubts, but then ending up with a positive self-statement or a strengths-based statement. So an example might be something like, I feel stuck because I wanted to be at such and such part of my life, at this stage of my life. But currently, I'm actually feeling like things are at this other point. And then we could help them cultivate specific, measurable, meaningful goals. We talked about having a positive approach. One of the ways of doing this also is the exercise I've included in your PowerPoints called the eulogy. Sometimes it's important for us to look at, what do I want to be remembered for? Thinking of maybe 3 to 5 main things. Because a lot of times what we focus on, what's stressing us out, isn't really what we want to be remembered for. For example, let's say even in your life as a clinician, there may be things that you wanted to do to impact, to help your clients. But probably, I'm guessing, it's not writing the best clinical notes or fighting with insurance companies to get paid. It might be more helping people learn skills and make a difference. We can help people with their goal orientation. If there was no one left on the planet to judge their actions or to criticize or hold them back, what would they do now to achieve a meaningful life? What new things would they do? What would they do more or less of? How would they act towards other people? What about towards themselves? Would they try new actions? Would they be more merciful towards themselves? Would they let go of changes from the past? Now, in this next section, we're going to go through a few little exercises and just talk about how we can reframe these scenarios in terms of a more positive approach.